I'm Peter Suderman, and this is The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week. Thanks for listening. If you want less expensive housing, you need more housing. And the way to get more housing is actually pretty simple. You have to let people build it. But that seemingly simple solution has turned out to be incredibly difficult, mostly because of politics.
Building affordable housing in California. He says the job keeps getting harder.
The rules got more complicated. Life got more complicated. Construction costs started climbing 10% a year. We went from a 3-year timeline to maybe a 6-year timeline now.
More specifically, the problem is zoning. Local zoning rules put limits on what can be built and where. Zoning rules restrict how high a building can be or how many units can occupy a given parcel of land. In some cases, they also require aesthetic features that can be cumbersome or expensive to build.
Single-family homes will be torn down and design guidelines won't go far enough to protect a neighborhood's character.
Particularly in terms of working with developers to say, this is what you can build, this is what you have to do.
In other words, zoning makes housing more scarce and more expensive. But zoning can also be quite popular with local homeowners, and even unpopular rules can persist when backed by small groups of vocal supporters in a community.
The single-family home neighborhood has always been the sacred cow of zoning.
In theory, President Joe Biden has staked out opposition to the worst of these building restrictions. While campaigning for president, for example, he backed loosening zoning rules. The bipartisan infrastructure law Biden signed last year contained billions of dollars for transportation grants that the administration indicated could go to localities that reformed their strict zoning laws. This was part of the administration's housing supply action plan, which the White House has described as a plan to ease the burden of housing costs.
There's a reason it hasn't been done in 70 years. It's complex. It's difficult. There are a lot of folks that aren't interested in change. Well, here I'm here to tell you folks, growth is coming. Change is coming.
But that plan has produced disappointing results. Here to talk about all of this today is Reason Associate Editor and resident zoning expert Christian Britschke. He's spent the last several years covering zoning battles in obsessive detail.
Since only 25% of all residential land is allowed to be not a house, developers are fighting over scraps, and that leads to this distinct feature in American cities. Suburbs, 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 and then boom, skyscrapers out of nowhere.
Christian, what is the Biden administration's housing supply action plan, and why has it failed?
Sure. So the housing supply action plan is kind of a scattershot of different policies the Biden administration threw out there. It includes everything from, you know, expanding federal financing for different types of housing to, you know, spending more money on actually building housing, affordable housing. And then there was an interest for, free market.
So affordable
type
housing isn't market rate housing, right?
Yeah, that's an important question. The Biden administration, they want to expand funding for capital A affordable housing, which is housing where the rent is tied to a certain percentage of your income. And if it's targeted at lower income people, then it's going to be well below market rate. You might be paying, if you're a lower income person, you might be paying $1,000 to live in this unit when the market rate would be, $2,500, $3,000.
So it's affordable effectively because of some combination of subsidies and what are basically price controls.
Yes, 100%. So the administration proposed spending more money building those kinds of units. And then for the most interesting part for free marketers was that it was going to put in some conditions on federal transportation grant programs that would reward jurisdictions who adopted zoning policies reform that allowed for more housing construction, more market rate housing construction.
And so in some ways, that was the Biden administration acknowledging that zoning rules, that regulations prohibiting the building of housing were at least contributing to the problem of too little housing and too expensive housing.
That's right. On the rhetorical front, the Biden administration has actually been pretty good on this. They've frequently called out, going back to the campaign trail, exclusionary zoning, restrictions on building new housing as the reason why we have such high housing costs. Unfortunately, when it actually comes to the policy, it's been a little less exciting. So the administration in its housing supply action plan listed a couple grant programs that they were going to retool to reward jurisdictions that reform their zoning codes. We've seen some of these grant awards come out, and there's no evidence that they're actually considering zoning policy changes when they're awarding this money. A good example of this is in the RAISE grant program, transportation grant program, that the infrastructure bill gave a lot more money to. This was one of the ones that they were going to retool and give to, jurisdictions that were trying to build more housing. And one of the largest awards from that program went to San Francisco, which has some problems with approving new housing.
Known for very inexpensive housing. Right. It's easy to build. You could basically just put anything up on any piece of land.
Right, sure. And in fact, a week after the Biden administration announced they were giving a grant to San Francisco from this program that's supposed to incentivize zoning reform, the state of California announced that it's investigating San Francisco for why exactly is it continually shooting down new housing. So this is disappointing results, to say the least.
So why the disconnect here? Why is the Biden administration saying, look, the problem is that we have very restrictive zoning laws, and also we're going to give money to cities and localities that reform their zoning laws, and then when it actually comes to give out the money, they give it to San Francisco, which is just has been maybe the single worst place, certainly the most notorious city in the United States when it comes to restrictive zoning and high housing costs?
A couple reasons. So the first is the grant programs that they chosen to retool to reward, you know, supposedly reformist jurisdictions. The reason they chose these grant programs is because they give the administration a lot of discretion to decide where the money goes. But because you have so much discretion in where the money goes, administrations have used these programs basically as slush funds to reward political allies. And, you know, there's no reason you'd give up the power to reward political allies if you don't have to. In this case, they haven't. They've decided they want to send money towards political cronies more than they want to incentivize zoning reform. I mean, the other issue...
So just to go back to this a little bit, this idea that this money is being used to reward political allies, the RAISE funds that you are talking about, there was a boost to the RAISE funds included in the bipartisan infrastructure bill, right?
Yep.
But that program has existed before the infrastructure bill. And prior to the infrastructure bill, that money was mostly used as a kind of earmark money, right?
Yes.
Just to hand out to local politicians to say, hey, thanks for being on our side.
Yep.
Go build a park. Go put something, you know, go have the honorable memorial you thing that you can build in your district and say, hey, we built this.
Yeah, 100%. So the RAISE grant goes back initially to the stimulus bill passed in the wake of the Great Recession. The Obama administration used it to build, streetcars in Portland. The Trump administration used it to build highways in the middle of nowhere in rural districts. And now the Biden administration is using it to build, bike lanes in San Francisco or wherever. And again, you don't really see too much difference in how the RAISE grants are being used now that they've inserted this zoning reform language into it. So that would be the big reason why I think this hasn't been successful. The other one is that it's just actually kind of hard to get the federal government to incentivize local jurisdictions to reform their zoning codes. This hasn't really been something that's been done before. There's a lot of different ideas about how you could actually do this effectively. And so it's a difficult policy to implement. And so I think it would require congressional action to really get a effective policy on the books. And that's always kind of a difficult thing to do, obviously.
Yeah, I think part of the problem here is pretty clearly that this is an attempt at a federal solution to what is at heart a local problem. At the same time, the federal government has contributed to this, especially in the recent years, right? I mean, during the pandemic, the CDC decided it was going to become the nation's landlord, suspended evictions. And this was supposedly going to be something that would help people who were struggling with paying for housing. But, you know, what they said was essentially there's no serious consequences for not paying rent. How did that contribute to our current housing headaches?
Sure. I mean, the most obvious example is that it led a lot of people to accumulate a huge amount of rent debt that they were never going to be able to pay back. And so now that eviction moratoriums are easing, a lot of people are, you know, stuck with these debts and now being evicted. And it also means that a lot of landlords are, you know, massively in a, you know, have massive debts that they are owed that, they're never going to see that money again because they weren't able to maybe evict a tenant who wasn't paying and get in one that was paying. And so, you know, you've seen some evidence that this has reduced housing supply on the margins. Someone who would maybe have been willing to rent out, one half of a duplex to a renter is maybe going to think twice if they don't have, you know, legal certainty that they can remove a delinquent tenant. So there's some evidence that that's suppressed housing supply. And when you already have suppressed housing supply, obviously that's going to drive up prices even more.
We hear the term housing crisis thrown around a lot. And the Biden administration's plan is in part an attempt to respond to this idea that there is a housing crisis. Do you agree with that language? Do you think that this is a crisis and that it is one that politicians should be involved in solving?
Firstly, yeah, I would say it is a crisis. I mean, you look at these varying estimates of how many houses the United States should have versus how many it does have, and the gap is, you know, the shortage is anywhere from 4 million homes to 20 million homes. So that's a significant shortage. On top of that, you look at rates of home building, and, you know, we're producing far less housing than we used to. In a place like New York City, they're building less housing now than they were during the Great Depression, which was, you know, not a great time for housing construction generally. So there's definitely, and you see this in the continuing rise in home prices, continuing rise in rents. Cities across the country have seen double-digit increases in rent prices in recent years. They've seen similar increases in home prices, particularly during the pandemic. And people are getting priced out. You see these massive movements away from high-income, high-productivity cities to lower-cost cities. People are taking cuts to their wages effectively because the costs of housing are so high in places where they could earn more money. That's not something you should see in a functioning market. So it is a crisis. Politicians have a role in fixing this, mostly because they've erected rules that have caused the problem in the first place. So, you know, there is a lot of need for policy action on this. There is a lot of need for reform, but it all should run in the direction of liberalizing the ability to build housing, liberalizing the ability to get credit to, you know, borrow money to build a home. That's what would address this problem.
There was an amazing chart that circulated on neoliberal housing policy Twitter, which either very fortunately or very unfortunately is a real thing, showing the decline of starter homes, basically the just absolute drop-off in homes costing under $300,000. And so, I mean, to purchase a home that costs more than $300,000, you have to be maybe not rich, but at least relatively well-off financially, relatively financially stable, and that just doesn't exist anymore. And so part of I think what's missing from this conversation, and, you know, sort of correct me if I'm wrong here, is that it's not just that we should be building more homes. It's that we should be building more homes that are less expensive to build, less expensive to buy, less expensive to rent. And that, I mean, there should be more housing variation. You mentioned the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, it wasn't like they were building a lot of McMansions and, you know, luxury apartments. In fact, a lot of people back then lived in hotels. And there was just a sort of a wider variety of types of dwellings that people lived in, especially in cities where people might live in really quite small units in some cases, as well as, of course, you know, the sort of rich and fancy mansions for people who are quite well off. And it seems to me that a big part of the problem here is not just sort of the idea that, oh, you know, we're going to restrict developers from building this 500 unit building here, but also that we're going to restrict the type of dwellings that people can live in. We're going to say they have to be a certain size. They've got to have a certain number, you know, of windows, square footage, whatever it is. They all have to have this a certain number of amenities, including kitchen amenities. And it's not necessarily the case that everybody needs all of those amenities, right? Can you just sort of talk me through, like, how we went from a world in which it was very common, even for middle-class people, to live in a hotel for a year in New York, to a world in which essentially that doesn't happen anymore, unless you're a weird person who makes millions and millions of dollars and can afford to live in the Ritz?
Right, yeah. So the thing to understand about zoning is that it's often been done explicitly to ban the types of housing that poor people would live in. So as you mentioned, you know, zoning laws, there's things like minimum lot size requirements, where you have to, you know, your property has to be 5,000 feet before you can build a house on it. And then on top of that, you maybe have to have a minimum home size requirement where your home has to be a certain size. So both those things, you're requiring people to use more land than they might, you're requiring people to build a larger house than they might, and then on top of the number, you know, of restrictions on the number of units you can build, you know, if you could build a, you know, a fourplex or something, then you can split those land costs between four different families. But if you have to build a single family home, that's going to go to one person who therefore is going to have a higher income to afford it. Yeah, cities have explicitly banned all sorts of affordable housing typologies is the term. So that can be residential hotels, you mentioned, where you would live in, you know, just a room with a bed, and then maybe you'd have a communal kitchen or a communal bathroom. And because you're splitting those amenities between a lot of different people, this was kind of the bottom floor of the housing ladder where, you know, if you were, you know, a poor person temporarily employed or occasionally employed with a drinking problem, you could still afford a place in an SRO, a single room occupancy hotel.
And the argument against that type of housing was, well, that's bad housing, right? It's not good housing. But the alternative ends up being that those people often don't have houses at all, right? If we eliminate the inexpensive housing that may have some sort of behavioral, cultural problems associated with it, whether or not the housing is actually causing it, I think is, you know, at least an open question and probably wrong. But if we eliminate very inexpensive housing that a middle-class person might look at and say, man, that's really unfortunate housing, it doesn't mean that the person who was living there ends up living, you know, in a three-bedroom on a third of an acre in a suburb.
No, they end up living in a tent in a park. You know, there's a perfect example of this in North Las Vegas recently, where a homeless nonprofit had built some tiny homes in which, you know, for people who are living on the streets to move into. And then the city shut this down, saying that they violated, you know, health and safety codes. It's like, well, what's better for health and safety, for these people to live in an actual structure or for them to go back sleeping outside? So yeah, it's, you know, single room occupancies, they weren't the Ritz, you know, they weren't, you know, the Hilton or whatever, but they were better than sleeping outside. And this is why you have these massive, really chronic homeless problems in places like, you know, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, because we've made the cheapest type of housing, the housing for the most vulnerable people, the most expensive and the most overregulated.
Yeah, I think sometimes people just don't realize how much zoning interferes with kind of all aspects of our lives. I mean, zoning sort of penetrates the cultural consciousness in ways that we don't really think about, including, you know, people experiencing homelessness. I mean, since you've brought this up a little bit, you have been writing about churches and charities who have attempted to build housing, shelter for people who are experiencing homelessness, especially during the pandemic when, of course, you know, sort of traditional kind of group housing became, at least the perception of it was that it was more dangerous. Mm-hmm. And zoning rules have been a huge barrier, even when these organizations have the will and they have the money, they've mm-hmm. got the construction lined up, it's ready to go, but they can't because the city or the community says, there are rules here, you can't build this.
Yeah, there was this awkward moment in the pandemic when traditional existing homeless shelters were, the term is decompressing, where they were basically telling, you know, people that they had to leave, a certain percentage of people they had to leave to accommodate social distancing. And so into that gap poured all these nonprofits and churches who were like, hey, we have a spare building that we can use. We have spare room in our church. We can even set up a safe parking site on our property to accommodate some of these people coming out of the shelters. And they ran into, you know, you imagine if your local, you know, city is banning apartments, they're not going to look too favorably on homeless shelters either. And this is exactly what's happened. Cities across America, you know, shelters are probably the most restricted land use next to, you know, glue factories or, you know, nuclear power plants. The amount of land that you can actually legally put one on is very limited. I wrote about a shelter in Boise where, you know, the city did a whole survey looking for, you know, a place to put a new shelter. And in this entire 80 square mile city, they found two properties that could actually accommodate it. So there's very little land available for these shelters. And on top of that, the approval process is incredibly discretionary. So not, you know, if you're trying to build a shelter, you're doing it on your own property, which was the case about the shelter in Boise that I wrote about. You're doing it on your own property. You're using your own funds. You're not relying on any public funding. You still have to notify the neighbors and have a meeting with them about what you're trying to do with your land. Then you have to go before the planning commission, who will vote to allow you to use your land for a use that's already legal. And time and again, because of that requirement that you notify the neighbors, and because they have so many opportunities to provide input in this process, and generally they don't want to live next to a homeless shelter, the public officials who are approving these permits, you know, they're politicians, they will often reject these permits. And when you add that on top of the fact that there's so little land available for these uses, it means oftentimes you can't build these things. You know, there's an interesting example I wrote about in North Carolina where there was a small town where you were allowed to build a homeless shelter in one zoning district in the entire town, which is like a highway business district. And then when it became time for the discretionary approval, they turned it down because they were worried that the homeless people that would live at the shelter would wander into traffic on the highway. So, you know, kind of a catch-22 there.
So you mentioned Boise, and that to me sort of is just a reminder that this isn't, we've talked a lot about, you know, San Francisco and mm-hmm. sort of extremely dense, you know, coastal cities. It's a reminder that this is not just a sort of coastal dense, you know, extremely lefty city. Boise does have a Democratic mayor, but like this isn't something that is, the zoning issues are not confined to deep blue, highly dense areas, right? There are complications in red states, in quite Republican suburbs, often that often have to do with single-family housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for a while there, the problems of high housing costs were primarily an issue with these ultra-expensive coastal metros. You know, that's New York, that's San Francisco, that's Los Angeles, where just zoning prevented them, you know, already dense cities from becoming denser, from adding new housing. But now it's those high housing costs have kind of escaped the lab. You know, they're hitting metros across the country where everyone has moved during the pandemic. It's been exacerbated by these population shifts during the pandemic. So Boise is one of the most rapidly, you know, places where housing costs are going up. Atlanta, Tampa, even a place like Houston, which does build a lot of housing, but has also seen a huge spike in demand. And, you know, a lot of this is driven by, you know, these cities have restrictive zoning policies, but didn't quite have the demand pushing up pressure on prices. Well, now they're seeing that demand. You have other related issues like restrictions on mortgage finance that came down in the wake of the Great Recession. So people are less able to get a loan to build a new home effectively. And so they're bidding up the cost of existing housing. That's another huge issue. And then there's just been all these other things related to the pandemic, these supply chain issues where it's just harder for builders to get the materials they need to complete a home. And, you know, maybe at the beginning of the pandemic, they were willing to start a project because the margins were high enough, but inflation has eaten into those margins. And so now you're starting to see home starts collapse, even though prices are high and rising. And so, yeah, it's a pretty bleak picture as far as affordability goes, pretty much nationwide.
But we can just fix this by subsidizing first-time homebuyers, right?
Right.
I mean, isn't this what Washington, D.C. is doing right now? Is they have a program where they are providing interest-free loans up to $202,000. The gag, of course, is that Washington, D.C.'s area code is 202. And they're just throwing money at the problem. Why do politicians continue to throw money at a problem that hasn't been solved by decades and decades of throwing money at it?
Probably because it's a little more politically practical. You get credit for spending the money. The people who receive the money feel like they're better off. But in the case of something like down payment assistance that you mentioned, you're just adding fuel to the fire. You're increasing demand. You're giving people money to buy the same stock of goods. That's only going to increase prices. You as a politician get credit for providing the goods. The beneficiary who gets the money feels good because they got the money and they're going to try and buy a home now. But you know, you're right. The problem doesn't get fixed. And the benefit of these down payment assistance programs is you don't have to then tackle all these politically problematic issues of reforming zoning codes, allowing for more supply, coming up against these entrenched interest groups that have created the problem in the first place.
But it just means that there's more money chasing the exact same amount of supply when the problem is that it's hard to build. I mean, the takeaway here is that there is a housing crisis and that both parties have made it worse. I think that's actually all the time we have today. Christian, thank you so much for talking with me here. One final note before we go. When we started this podcast, we envisioned it as a 10-episode season, and this is the 10th episode. So we are going to be taking a break after this week, and when we come back, you can expect some changes. We're going to be experimenting with the format and perhaps changing up the release schedule as well. Thank you for sticking with us through this initial run. As always, if you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. And if you like Reason's work generally, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been the Reason Rundown.